a lifelike individual out of a handful of details. And when we write dialogue, we suggest real speech without actually reproducing it. We impose purpose on speech that, in real life, can be messy, halting, and digressive. But perhaps the most important way fiction imposes order on chaos is through the creation of stories and plots. Often people will look at a real-life situation and say something like, boy, that would make a great novel. Writers get this all the time. Sometimes, after I've told a friend of mine something that happened to me in real life, that friend will say to me, well, there's your next book. Stories are so prevalent in human cultures and in our own personal lives that it's easy to think that they occur naturally in the world. We sometimes think that stories are like fruit hanging from a tree and that all a writer has to do is pluck them. But it's more complicated than that. Taking what Mrs. Giltner told me as scripture, it becomes axiomatic that all fiction has a structure. Even for narrative works that don't have plots, all fiction can be broken down into a few fundamental components. Specifically, all stories have a situation or a context, at least one character, a conflict of some sort, and a resolution to that conflict. All these elements are inextricably linked in every work of fiction, and if you're missing one of them, it won't work. The initial situation needs to be dramatically productive. In other words, the initial situation needs to produce a conflict. Furthermore, the character or characters need to have some sort of relationship to that situation. The conflict can be external to the characters, or it can be an internal conflict within a character. And the resolution must resolve that conflict in some believable and dramatically satisfying way, though not necessarily happily or pleasantly. Sometimes, in fact, the resolution of the conflict is that it doesn't get resolved. We'll look at that paradox in a later lecture, when I talk about narratives that don't use an ordinary plot. And let me add just one more thing. All fiction must possess a quality that the writer and teacher John Gardner called profluence. He defined profluence as the feeling you have when you're reading a novel or short story that you're getting someplace. Another way to think of this quality is simply to call it forward momentum. Whether you're writing a highly plotted, complicated story like Game of Thrones or Harry Potter, or a modernist plotless masterpiece like Mrs. Dalloway or Thomas Pynchon's epic novel Gravity's Rainbow, you need to give the reader a reason to keep turning the pages. Profluence doesn't necessarily mean that a story has a plot, per se. In a conventional narrative, you read to find out what happens next, but there are other reasons to keep reading. Sometimes, as in a plotless story like Anton Chekhov's story, The Kiss, you read to gain a deeper understanding of the central character, even if that character, as in The Kiss, never comes to understand himself. Or you might read just to inhabit a strange and richly detailed world, or to enjoy the author's writing style. For example, plot is secondary in Mervyn Peake's Gormenghast trilogy of fantasy novels, but they are still tremendous fun to read. The profluence in those books comes from their evocative detail, their wonderfully strange characters, and the author's gorgeous prose. We're going to talk about non-traditional structures in a later lecture, but in this lecture and the next two lectures, I'm going to talk about the old-fashioned traditional plot, which is still, by far, the most common structure for fiction. I think it's safe to say that our culture is dominated by the traditional plot, and not just in prose fiction. If you've ever, as I have, devoted an entire weekend to devouring all the episodes of a single season of The Wire, Battlestar Galactica, or Breaking Bad, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. All three of these shows are superb feats of long-form storytelling, and they offer many other riches besides simply a gripping plot. But on a first viewing, they turn the question, what happens next, into something as addictive as Walter White's blue meth. And yet, some fiction writers remain uneasy with the idea of plot. In his book, The Art of Fiction, John Gardner called plotting the hardest job a writer has. And from among the writers of my own acquaintance, I've heard that plotting is the part of the job that usually gives them the most anxiety. Some writers even think of plot as slightly disreputable. All the elements of fiction are fundamentally arbitrary impositions of order on the formless chaos of reality, and yet plotting is somehow seen as even more arbitrary than the rest. Probably no one has expressed this uneasiness as productively as our old friend E.M. Forster in Aspects of the Novel. At the beginning of his second chapter, he imagines three types of reader and asks the question, what does a novel do? The first reader seems a bit puzzled, as if he'd never considered this before, and he says, well, a novel tells a story, I suppose. The next reader, who's a bit of a blowhard, says, why, a novel tells a story, of course, and I've got no use for it if it doesn't. The third reader is Forster himself, who says, in a sort of drooping, regretful voice, yes, oh dear, yes, the novel tells a story. He then says that he wishes this were not so, and he calls storytelling a low, atavistic form. He then goes on to compare a story to a tapeworm, calling it a series of simple, linked segments laid out in chronological order. A story, he says, can only have one merit, that of making the audience want to know what happens next. And conversely, it can only have one fault, that of making the audience not want to know what happens next. I'll confess that I sometimes share this ambivalence. You may recall that in my first lecture about character, I defended talking about character before anything else by making the argument that you can write about characters without a plot, but you can't create a plot without characters. I even said that all fiction is character-driven, but that some fiction is more character-driven than others. Well, I'm not taking any of that back, but I want to take what Forster said about the one merit and the one fault of storytelling, and I want to apply it to all fiction, not just storytelling. Here's my version. A work of fiction can only have one merit, that of making the reader want to keep reading. And it can only have one fault, that of making the reader not want to keep reading. Note that my version takes Gardner's idea of profluence into account. In other words, we may want to keep reading for other reasons than plot, and not just to find out what happens next. In fact, there are all sorts of ways of generating profluence that don't necessarily put storytelling up front. In a later lecture, I'll talk about other ways to structure fiction and to give it forward momentum in order to keep that hypothetical reader turning the pages. But right now, I want to make the case that creating a good, engrossing, and yes, entertaining plot is one of the most satisfying things a writer can do. And I also want to make the case that creating a plot is no more arbitrary than creating characters. Think back to the story I concocted in my very first lecture about Sarah and Brad, the couple at the baseball game whose marriage was on the rocks. You could take the same series of events and tell it from several different points of view, from Sarah's, from Brad's, from a mutual friend's, even from the godlike, omniscient point of view of a narrator. You could also play with the order of events in all sorts of ways. You could tell the story strictly chronologically, starting from Sarah and Brad's first meeting and ending with their divorce. Or you could start from the moment where Sarah tells Brad she's unhappy and then show their previous relationship in flashback. Or you could even tell the whole story backwards, the way Julia Alvarez tells the story of a Dominican-American family in her novel How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, or the way Harold Pinter tells the story of an adulterous love affair in his play, Betrayal. Done well, each version of Sarah and Brad's story could be equally satisfying and meaningful, yet each would be very different from all the others. Each starts with the same series of events, but depending on how you order those events and whose point of view you tell them from, the same situation could amount to a completely different story in each version. Plotting is an incredibly powerful tool, but like any powerful tool, it's difficult to handle. If you don't take enough control over it, your plot will seem loose and formless with no forward momentum. You'll end up with a series of events that have no particular importance or obvious meaning, too much like real life, in other words. But if you use narrative too forcefully, you could end up with something melodramatic, mechanical, contrived, and unbelievable. We've all read books where the characters appear to be little more than puppets of the author. Even if the characters are fully rounded, they are often required to do unbelievable things in order for a plot to come out a certain way. So, how do we avoid contrivance? How do we create stories out of formless events and create an order that seems both satisfying and lifelike? Let's return to E.M. Forster again. He clarified this problem by making a distinction between stories and plots. In a very famous passage in Aspects of the Novel, he defines a story as simply a series of events linked by their chronology, but he defines a plot as a series of events linked by cause and effect. Here's Forster in his own words. The king died, and then the queen died, is a story. The king died, and then the queen died of grief, is a plot. The time sequence is preserved, but the sense of causality overshadows it. Or again, the queen died, no one knew why, until it was discovered that it was through grief at the death of the king. This is a plot with a mystery in it, a form capable of high development. It suspends the time sequence. It moves as far away from the story as its limitations will allow. If it is in a story, we say, and then? If it is in a plot, we ask, why? Just like Forster's distinction between flat and round characters, this is one of the most famous tropes in creative writing. And like a lot of famous pronouncements, it's easy to oversimplify it. I still love placing things on a continuum. So perhaps it might help if we think of stories and plots being at the opposite ends of the same continuum, with the most basic chronological story at one end of the continuum and the most subtle plot at the other. Let's look at some examples. Often the most addictive stories are the ones that simply answer the question, as Forster puts it, and then? These are the stories we like best as children, the ones we beg our parents to read over and over again. On a first reading, children can't stand not knowing how the story turns out, but they insist on repeat readings because they take comfort in revisiting the same steps the story took in getting to the end. And children often insist on hearing the story told in exactly the same way, and they become frustrated and disappointed if you vary the details even slightly. This reinforces the idea that with a good story, it's not just the destination, it's the journey. And as we get older, that desire to learn the answer to "and then" never really leaves us. When you're gobbling down episodes of Breaking Bad and neglecting the rest of your life, you're watching the story in the same way you used to lose yourself in a book as a child. Much of the pleasure we derive from even a mediocre Hollywood blockbuster comes from watching the story unfold one plot point at a time, and we still derive that pleasure even if the story is predictable, as many blockbusters are. Take one of my favorite action pictures, for example, Die Hard, in which a tough New York City cop named John McClane takes on a bunch of terrorists in a Los Angeles skyscraper. Even watching that film for the very first time back in 1988, I pretty much knew how it was going to end. Spoiler alert, the terrorists lose. But the predictability of the plot didn't diminish my pleasure in watching the story twist and turn step by step to reach the inevitable triumph of Bruce Willis. And knowing exactly how it ends hasn't diminished my pleasure in watching it at least a half dozen times since. Because it's a clever story with vivid, if not especially complicated characters, the film works as an unusually seductive sequence of and thens, with each sequence being a little more over the top than the last. Closer to the middle of the continuum, between story at one end and plot at the other, are such blockbuster literary series as the Harry Potter books by J.K. Rowling, or the epic fantasy series A Song of Ice and Fire by George R.R. Martin, better known in its HBO version as Game of Thrones. The overarching story of each of these series of novels moves relentlessly forward chronologically. The Harry Potter books start with Harry Potter being chosen to attend the wizard's school at Hogwarts, and they end years later with an epic battle at the school between good and evil. A Song of Ice and Fire starts just before the start of an all-out war between several aristocratic houses, which will determine who is going to be the ruler of Martin's imaginary medieval world of Westeros. Each of these series are tremendous feats of old-fashioned storytelling. Just ask any of the countless readers who have stood in line at a bookstore on publication day and then raced home to do nothing for the next 24 hours but read the latest installment. But these narratives are more complicated than Die Hard. Whereas Die Hard moves forward chronologically with no flashbacks and only a few references in dialogue to previous events, most of the narrative momentum of Harry Potter involves Harry figuring out what happened between his parents and the villain Voldemort before he was born. We get this information in flashbacks, stories from other characters, mysterious documents, and magic visions. Rowling very skillfully mixes up the chronology of the backstory and gives us all sorts of information out of order, even as the main story moves unstoppably forward. Each of these non-chronological additions moves the Harry Potter books away from Forster's simple chronological tapeworm, what will happen to Harry next, and towards Forster's idea of a plot. Why is Harry so important? It's a plot, in other words, and not just a story. The construction of A Song of Ice and Fire is even more complicated. For one thing, the fictional world of Westeros has a long, convoluted history that precedes the events of the first book. And that previous history largely determines the existing relationships of the various aristocratic houses and the individual characters in them. For another thing, Martin's use of point of view is more complex than Rowling's. Whereas the Harry Potter books take place almost entirely from the point of view of Harry himself, A Song of Ice and Fire is told from the points of view of many characters, varying chapter by chapter. This also makes the chronology of A Song of Ice and Fire more complex. Especially in the later books, the same period of time is told from several different points of view, which means that the plot occasionally loops back on itself. And even though the books have a tremendous forward momentum, much of the pleasure in reading them comes from elements other than the plot. These other elements include the rich evocation of a fantasy world and access to the thoughts of some really interesting characters. In the end, of course, we want to know who wins the struggle for Westeros, and we want to know who lives and who dies. But along the way, there is much to savor that has little to do with simply answering the question, and then? Now, moving to the literary end of the story plot continuum, let's consider a book I talked about in my lectures about character, Joseph Conrad's great novel, Lord Jim. This book has one of the most complex plots in modern literature. Yet the basic events of the story are pretty simple. Bear with me as I go into a bit of detail. In the late 19th century, a romantic young Englishman, whom we know only as Jim, seeks his fortune as a sailor in the seas of South and Southeast Asia. Even before his career as a sailor has properly gotten started, he becomes the first mate of a rusting old freighter carrying Muslim pilgrims across the Indian Ocean to Mecca. When the freighter, called the Patna, collides with some unseen object in the water and threatens to sink, the rest of the crew prepares to abandon the ship, leaving the pilgrims to die. Jim considers himself superior to the other members of the crew, but at the last minute, he jumps into the lifeboat along with them. With this impulsive act, he instantly betrays his own sense of honor and shatters his naive conception of himself as heroic. After Jim and the rest of the crew are rescued and arrive in port, however, they learn that the Patna didn't sink after all. The rest of the crew disappear, but Jim deliberately turns himself in to the authorities in order to accept responsibility for what happened. At a tribunal of sea captains, he is stripped of his seaman's license, and his career and his reputation are ruined. After that, he drifts from job to job across Southeast Asia. Finally, he accepts a dangerous job far upriver on a remote island, and he helps a village defeat an oppressive warlord and win its freedom. By the end of the story, it looks as though Jim has found peace and redemption at last. But in a final series of incidents, which I won't give away, his past returns to destroy him. Told this way, chronologically, this sounds like a pretty straightforward story. It's an action-packed one at that, featuring storms at sea, dramatic courtroom encounters, and battles in the jungle. And it is exciting. I read it for the first time at the age of 10, after seeing the movie version starring Peter O'Toole. And as a child, I read it strictly as an adventure story. What I didn't recognize at that age, however, was how complex the plotting was. And I couldn't understand how the complexity of that plotting made it into something richer and more melancholy than a mere adventure story. Bear with me again for a few moments as I compare the chronological version, Forster's idea of story, with the way Conrad actually tells it, Forster's idea of plot. As you may recall from my lecture on character, Lord Jim opens with a description of Jim marching straight off the page at the reader. As it happens, that moment actually comes about halfway through the chronological version of the story, several years after Jim's disgrace at the trial, but before he goes upriver into the jungle. After that introduction, Conrad then jumps back to Jim's upbringing in Britain, then works forward chronologically to the moment when the Patna runs over something in the water. At that point, without saying what happens to the ship, Conrad jumps to Jim in the witness box at the trial a month later. Up till now, the novel has been narrated in the third person, but now the story is picked up by a first-person narrator named Marlowe. This narrator is talking to some acquaintances on a hotel veranda long after the trial, but before the final events of the book. Marlowe tells them about attending the trial. Then he jumps back a few weeks to tell how he witnessed the arrival in port of the rescued crew of the Patna before it was discovered that the Patna hadn't actually sunk. Marlowe then returns to the trial with a long digression about one of the members of the tribunal, Captain Brierley, who commits suicide not long after the verdict. Then Marlowe tells of meeting of Jim in the street shortly after the verdict and of inviting him to dinner at his hotel. At this point, over the course of the next several chapters, Jim tells Marlowe what really happened that fateful night on the Patna. And that is only the first quarter of the book. The rest of the book is equally complex. I want you to note that not only does Conrad jumble the chronology, he also tells the story through several layers of point of view. There's the unnamed third-person narrator who starts the book. Then within that narration, there is Marlowe speaking in the first person within quotation marks. And within Marlowe's first-person account, there's Jim's account of what happened on the Patna, which is told in the third person by Marlowe with occasional snatches of Jim's actual words in the first person. Got all that? We're a long way from Die Hard here. In fact, we're even a long way from Game of Thrones. If you tell Lord Jim chronologically, it's a fairly straightforward tale about a young man who makes a bad mistake and then tries to redeem himself. But told the way Conrad does, through various narrators, with the story starting in the middle and looping backwards and forwards, it becomes an intimate and intense psychological study of a character who was not redeemed by his idealistic conception of honor, but in the end, destroyed by it. Now, think back to what Forster said about the difference between a story and a plot. A story answers the question, and then, and a plot answers the question, why? A simple story like Die Hard has a binary resolution. Does Bruce Willis defeat the terrorists, or doesn't he? Harry Potter is a bit more complicated, because we learn a lot of backstory along the way. Also, the world of Harry Potter is more complex than the world of Die Hard. But in the end, the story comes down to another binary resolution. Does Harry Potter defeat Voldemort, or doesn't he? Game of Thrones is more complicated still, with more points of view, a more complex imaginary world, and a much darker view of human nature. Book by book, there are winners and losers, but the author complicates things by sometimes letting the people we hate win and letting the people we love lose and even die on occasion. Game of Thrones is a richer experience because it answers both questions. Readers rip through the books to find out what happens next, but what makes reading them so satisfying is that each volume also answers the question, why are these things happening? Each of the leading characters becomes more complex and rounded as the plot progresses. Characters we thought were old-fashioned heroes begin to show weakness, bad judgment, and even cruelty, while characters we hated from the start turn out to show flashes of tenderness and compassion. Conrad's plot in Lord Jim is the most complex of all these examples, and yet, oddly enough, it may be the most realistic of all of them. Chronological narratives seem lifelike because we seem to experience our lives in chronological order without knowing what's going to happen next. But while Conrad's method may not mimic the way Jim's life happens, it does mimic, in a very lifelike way, the manner in which most of us learn about the other people in our lives. Think about someone you've met as an adult and have gotten to know really well, your spouse perhaps, or a good friend, and then think about how you learned about them. Chances are, that person didn't sit down with you on your first meeting and tell you his or her whole life story in chronological order from birth. Rather, you got a vivid first impression, and then over days or weeks or years, the rest of that person's life was revealed to you in bits and pieces and out of chronological order. This is how the plot in Lord Jim works, and it results in a much more intense and intimate experience of the character. The reader is given the basic information about Jim's life, and then expected to assemble it in chronological order without any help from Jim, or for that matter, the author. Some readers, of course, won't want to put in the effort, and that's fine. But for those of us who do, we come to know the character of Jim as intimately as we would one of our best friends. The conclusion of Lord Jim is very powerful. Even though I've read it at least as many times as I've seen Die Hard, it never fails to shake me up. The final effect is not just, oh, so that's how it turned out, or take that, Voldemort, but a profound understanding of how a person's best qualities can sometimes lead to his ruin. Before I wrap this lecture up, I want to make clear that I'm not saying that simple storytelling is inferior and that complex, non-chronological, modernist plotting is superior. One of my other favorite books, and one of the greatest novels ever written, is George Eliot's massive Victorian novel, Middlemarch. This book has a wonderful, complex plot with many strands, but it moves forward just as chronologically as Die Hard or Game of Thrones, only with a lot fewer explosions and beheadings. And I really, really love Die Hard. It's just that narratives like Die Hard's and narratives like Lord Jim's reach different regions of a reader's heart and brain, and they serve different functions for the writer. Now here's an exercise to help you explore the difference between a story and a plot. List all the major plot points of a story you admire or a story of your own, but write them out on index cards, one plot point to a card, in the order in which they actually appear in the story. If it's a narrative which is told out of chronological order, try putting the cards in chronological order and see how it changes the effect of the narrative. If it's a narrative that already moves chronologically, lay the cards out and see what happens if you start rearranging them. And if you want to be especially bold, just shuffle the cards and try retelling the story in whatever order they end up in. Deciding how to arrange the events of a narrative helps to determine what you want the reader to take away from it. In the next lecture, I'll explain the famous Freytag Pyramid by using The Wizard of Oz as an example. And in the subsequent lectures about plot, I'll look at different types and techniques of plotting and give you some suggestions for making choices about just what kind of story you want to tell.
Lecture 10. Plotting with the Freytag Pyramid.
Everybody thinks they know how to tell a joke. What that usually means in practice is that most of us understand, at least intuitively, the basic structure of the typical joke. You introduce a situation with a twist in it. The joke exploits the twist to build tension. And then the tension is released as a punchline, which usually involves a reversal of expectations. There are countless jokes that follow this structure, and depending on the content of the joke and the delivery of the joke teller, the amazing thing is that most people still find this sort of joke funny. It doesn't matter that the structure is simple and predictable. It doesn't matter that we know instinctively that the joke's going to end in a reversal. The fact is, when most of us hear the phrase, "A guy walks into a bar," our ears perk up. We know exactly what to expect. Situation, twist, punchline. You'd think this would prevent us from being surprised, and yet we also expect to laugh at the end of it. It's a very reliable, almost reflexive response. In fiction, the structure of the traditional plot works in much the same way, especially in popular fiction and very often in literary fiction as well. When we start reading a certain type of story, a mystery story, say, or a romance novel, we're given a particular situation we've seen many times before. A detective is called to the scene of a murder, or a young couple have a cute meeting. Then a conflict or a complication arises. The murdered body was found alone in a room that was locked from the inside, or the couple dislike each other intensely on first sight. Then the story or novel proceeds to work its way through the conflict. The detective searches for clues, interviews witnesses, and finds herself threatened by the murderer or someone who was protecting the murderer. The lovers circle each other warily as the rest of the plot revolves around them. Finally, the detective catches the murderer, or at least learns the murderer's identity, and the sparring lovers come to their senses, fall into each other's arms, and live happily ever after, as we always knew they would. This basic structure, situation, conflict, resolution, was first codified by the Greek philosopher Aristotle in his work The Poetics, in which he names and defines the various elements that make up a tragic drama. To this day, 2,300 years after his death, people still talk about a narrative having an Aristotelian structure. It's beyond the scope of this lecture for me to explain Aristotle's theory in detail, but suffice it to say that he was the first to state explicitly that a story should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. He was also the first to say that the events of the plot should be both causally connected and self-contained, and that the ending of the plot, and remember that he's talking specifically about tragedy here, should provide both closure and catharsis. Aristotle also introduces the concepts of the protagonist and the antagonist, or the two major characters who are in conflict with each other. But when we're talking about prose fiction these days, Freytag's Pyramid is more commonly referred to than Aristotle. Freytag's Pyramid is a graph of dramatic structure based on Aristotle's theory and created by an otherwise obscure 19th century German novelist and playwright named Gustav Freytag. This distinctive sketch of a pyramid, which is actually more of a triangle, has been a staple of literature and creative writing classes for years, and depending on who's explaining it, Freytag's Pyramid is made up of either 5, 6, or 7 elements. For the sake of completeness, I'm going to explain the 7-element version. As the name suggests, these elements are usually graphed in the shape of a pyramid. Starting at ground level on the left-hand side of the pyramid and rising towards the top, the first 3 elements are the exposition, the inciting incident, and the rising action. At the peak of the pyramid is the climax, which is the moment of greatest emotion or drama. Then the pyramid descends on the right-hand side in the falling action, the resolution, and it ends at ground level again on the other side with the denouement. In order to show this pyramid in practice, I'm going to use a story everybody knows, namely the plot of the film version of The Wizard of Oz. The exposition stage of a story sets the scene and introduces the characters. In The Wizard of Oz, the exposition is everything that happens from the beginning of the film all the way up to the tornado. During this section, we meet Dorothy Gale, who lives on a farm in Kansas with her Aunt Em and Uncle Henry, as well as the farmhands Hunk, Zeke, and Hickory. We also meet their mean neighbor, Miss Gulch, who has been bitten by Dorothy's dog, Toto, and who wants to have Toto put to sleep. As a result of this threat, Dorothy runs away with Toto and meets the medicine show pitchman, Professor Marvel. He sends her back to her family, but on her way back to the farm, Dorothy is overtaken by a storm. By the time we get to the tornado, at the end of the exposition, all the major characters have been introduced. Next comes the inciting action, which is the event that introduces conflict into the story. The inciting action of The Wizard of Oz is a bit ambiguous because there are 2 different elements in the story that might be called the conflict. One is the conflict between Dorothy on the one hand and Miss Gulch on the other, because Miss Gulch wants Dorothy's dog put to death. This is what causes Dorothy to run away from home, leading directly to her getting conked on the head during the tornado. In that sense, you might consider Miss Gulch's threat the inciting moment. But then this conflict becomes more complicated a few minutes later when the tornado transports Dorothy to the Land of Oz. There, Dorothy's house lands on the Wicked Witch of the East and kills her, and the witch's sister, the Wicked Witch of the West, threatens to kill Dorothy in revenge. However, this is really just the same conflict because the Wicked Witch of the West is actually just Miss Gulch in her Oz incarnation, and in both incarnations she wants to harm Dorothy. In fact, using Aristotle's terminology, we now have a protagonist, Dorothy, and an antagonist, Miss Gulch, a.k.a. the Wicked Witch. But there's another conflict that arises after Dorothy lands in Oz, and that's the fact that she wants to go home and nobody knows how to send her back to Kansas. These 2 conflicts, Dorothy versus the Wicked Witch and Dorothy's quest to go home, are linked, of course, and they get linked even more explicitly later on. Let's just say that by time Dorothy starts down the yellow brick road, the inciting incident has already happened. The rising action is the part where the plot gets more complicated and exciting, building tension along the way. Here's where you get twists and obstacles and digressions. As a result of these obstacles, in most stories, the rising action makes up the majority of the plot. In The Wizard of Oz, the rising action includes Dorothy's departure from Munchkinland and her meetings with the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion, whom we've already met in the exposition as Hunk, Zeke, and Hickory. The rising action also includes her arrival in the Emerald City, her first audience with the Wizard of Oz, who is really, of course, Professor Marvel, and her capture by the Wicked Witch of the West. Along the way, obstacles are thrown in the path of Dorothy and her companions. During the scene where she and the Scarecrow discover the Tin Man, they are attacked by the talking trees, and the witch turns up to threaten them with a fireball. Then Dorothy, the Scarecrow, and the Tin Man tame the Cowardly Lion after he attacks them, and after that, they survive the witch's attempt to put them all to sleep in the poppy field. During this part of the story, the two conflicts I mentioned earlier are reemphasized. Once Dorothy and her companions arrive in the Emerald City, the Wicked Witch's rage at Dorothy is spelled out in the sky when she writes the words, "Surrender Dorothy," in smoke with her broomstick. Then Dorothy, trembling before the big flaming head of the wizard, asks for his help in sending her home. The two conflicts are then explicitly linked when the wizard tells Dorothy he'll help her get back to Kansas if she brings him the witch's broomstick. Dorothy and her companions then face their most difficult challenge, with Dorothy getting carried away by the flying monkeys in the haunted forest, and her companions breaking into the witch's castle to rescue her. All of these scenes, from Dorothy's arrival in Oz to the final showdown in the witch's castle, constitute the story's rising action, and they make up much of the running time of The Wizard of Oz. This brings us to the climax, which is the most dramatic and exciting event in the story. The climax of The Wizard of Oz comes when Dorothy and her friends are trapped in the witch's castle, and she kills the Wicked Witch by dousing her with a bucket of water. It's without a doubt the most heart-stopping moment in the film, no matter how many times you've seen it. And at that moment, much of the film's tension is released, because at least one of the conflicts, the one between Dorothy and the witch, is ended, and the plot begins its descent down the other side of the pyramid. The next element is called the falling action, which is made up of the events that result directly from the moment of climax, and the element after that is called the resolution, where the main character's conflict is resolved. In a detective story, catching or revealing the killer is often the climax, after which there isn't much else to relate. In a romance, the lovers usually declare their love for each other only a few pages before the end of the novel, and just like in the detective story, not much happens after the climax. In The Wizard of Oz, after Dorothy has killed the Wicked Witch, she takes the witch's broomstick back to the wizard. Then the wizard, after a little persuading, solves the problems of the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion with something for each of them out of his big black bag. As for Dorothy, he agrees to take her back to Kansas himself. That's the falling action. It shows the results of the death of the witch, but it still hasn't resolved Dorothy's second conflict, the fact that she wants to go home to Kansas. That moment, the resolution, comes when the wizard accidentally takes off in his balloon without Dorothy, and Dorothy learns from Glinda the Good Witch that she could have taken herself back to Kansas at any time by using the ruby slippers. At this point, Dorothy's conflict is finally resolved. The threat from the witch is liquidated, so to speak, and she realizes she always had the power to go home. The denouement is the ending of the story, when order is restored. The word denouement is the French word for untying, which frankly seems a little counterintuitive to me. We usually talk about tying up the loose threads of a plot, but if you think of it as referring to untying the knot of the conflict, I suppose it makes sense. But at any rate, during the denouement, we are often shown all the major characters one more time so we can see what happened to them. In The Wizard of Oz, it's the final scene in Dorothy's bedroom, where she is reunited with Aunt Em and Uncle Henry, and also with the now suspiciously familiar farmhands. Even the Wizard of Oz himself returns in the final moments in the form of Professor Marvel. Miss Gulch is nowhere to be seen because, of course, she has been killed off in her incarnation as the Wicked Witch. In this final scene, both Dorothy and the narrative are literally returned home, back to where they both began. In some stories, this simply means that order has been restored and the world is now back to the way it was. But this isn't always the case, and it's certainly not the case in The Wizard of Oz. Dorothy is back home, where she wanted to be, but this is not to say that everything is back to the way it was before she went to Oz. Dorothy's understanding of herself and her place in the world has profoundly changed. After the strangeness and the violence she experienced in Oz, order has been restored, but she is a wiser and stronger person. Now, I've gone into so much detail about this particular structure because it's the sturdy, reliable, ubiquitous, and often predictable structure of countless books, stories, plays, movies, and television series. And predictability is not necessarily a bad thing. Predictability can be enormously reassuring and satisfying. I've seen The Wizard of Oz probably at least once a year for the last 50 years. The tornado never fails to thrill me. The witch never fails to terrify me, and Dorothy saying goodbye to the scarecrow never fails to make me cry. The appeal of this simple, sturdy structure runs deep. Some people even think there's something instinctual about it, something hardwired in our consciousness that makes us want to see the world ordered into stories like these. The disadvantage of this traditional structure, however, is that it can also be a one-size-fits-all straitjacket. Think of the countless best-selling novels or blockbuster movies that are pretty much cut to the same pattern. With too many conventionally plotted novels, you can not only guess the ending after the first few pages, you can often guess it from the jacket copy before you even open the book. The publishing industry and Hollywood don't exactly help the situation by turning out books and movies that are carbon copies of earlier books and movies that have done well. But we as readers bear some of the blame by rewarding the predictable and the reassuring, and by making it harder for more offbeat forms of storytelling to succeed. Sometimes you feel both reassured and annoyed at the same story. You may have guessed during the first 10 pages that the sparring lovers are eventually going to get together. But imagine how disappointed and annoyed you would be if it turns out at the end that they don't really like each other after all, and they wind up with other people. Or worse, they wind up alone. The predictable can be both disappointing and seductive at the same time. Even so, this particular narrative structure has proved to be surprisingly adaptable, considering that when first Aristotle and then, centuries later, Gustav Freytag outlined it, they were thinking only of stage tragedies. Plays, obviously, have a limited running time, and because of that limited running time, a limited number of scenes and characters. The plays Aristotle was familiar with, in fact, usually focused on the fate of a single central character, such as Oedipus or Medea or some other character from Greek history or mythology. He had never seen a novel, and certainly not a novel that works on an epic scale and incorporates lots of characters, more characters than you can fit into most plays. And yet the Aristotelian structure can be applied to everything from comedy to tragedy, from thrillers to love stories, from Hamlet to the X-Men. And for writers who are just starting out, Freytag's pyramid can serve as a set of training wheels, especially if you're uneasy about plotting. It's so common in our culture, in fact, that many writers adopt it instinctively, without really thinking about it. My own first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, can easily be graphed on Freytag's pyramid. And yet, at the time I was writing it, I had never heard of Freytag's pyramid. I was just feeling my way through the story organically, or so I thought. The fact that my book can easily be plotted along the pyramid is just proof of how deeply ingrained in our culture it is, as if it actually were something natural and instinctive. Freytag's pyramid seems so instinctive and ubiquitous because, in its simplest form, it is often the foundation for what I'm going to call a binary plot. I'm going to talk in more detail about binary plots in lectures 13 and 14, when I talk about how to start and how to end a narrative. But for now, I'll just say that a binary plot is one in which an either-or question is posed near the start of the narrative and then answered at the climax or resolution of the narrative. Who is the murderer? Will the two lovers ever get together? Will Dorothy ever get back to Kansas? There are all sorts of ways to complicate the answers to those questions, which I'll explore in the later lectures. But while we're talking about the traditional plot as a whole, I want to emphasize that there are ways to complicate this kind of plot long before you ever get to the end. A binary plot structured according to Freytag's pyramid doesn't have to be a simplistic or unsophisticated one. For one thing, you can scale up the story to take in a lot more time and many more characters than Aristotle or Freytag had in mind. You can do this by weaving together several binary plots or Freytag pyramids into one larger narrative. Take the great 19th century novel Middlemarch, for example, by the writer Mary Ann Evans, who wrote under the pen name George Eliot. It does have a main character. Dorothea Brooke is a beautiful, intellectual, and naively idealistic young woman. And it has a central plot line. Dorothea enters into a marriage with a much older religious scholar named Casaubon because she admires his intellect and his moral character. The marriage, predictably, is a disaster because Casaubon is a mediocre scholar and a passionless husband. It also fails because Dorothea is attracted to an intense young man her own age named Will Ladislaw. This love triangle is the central story of Middlemarch, but it takes up no more than a third of the book. There are two other major romantic relationships in the book. These include another unhappy marriage between an ambitious young doctor named Lydgate and a beautiful but shallow young woman named Rosamond, and a budding romance between Rosamond's charming but unreliable brother Fred and an earnest young woman named Mary. There's nothing unconventional or avant-garde about Middlemarch. Instead, it convincingly demonstrates that a conventionally plotted novel can still be sophisticated and true to life. Dorothea's story is plainly the narrative spine of the book, with a clearly defined beginning, middle, and end. But her story is enriched and complicated by all the other plot lines, each of which has a similar structure. Apart from a few flashbacks, all these plot lines move forward chronologically, but they are threaded together and interlinked, and in many cases, the events in one plot line have an effect on the others. The result is that it would be impossible to plot all of Middlemarch on only one Freytag's pyramid. Instead of one main story, we have several, all woven together, each one with its own conflict, rising action, and resolution. There's another way you can complicate a traditional plot, which I'm going to call the fractal plot. A fractal is a kind of mathematical pattern which is self-similar, which means that the pattern as a whole looks the same at a distance as it does up close in detail. Fractals often appear in nature. Trees are an excellent example. The limbs of a tree coming off the trunk make the same basic pattern as the branches coming off each limb, and the twigs make the same pattern coming off each branch, and so on. You can even take it down to the level of individual leaves, where the veins spread across each leaf like the pattern of branches. The point is, no matter whether you look at the tree from across a field or peer very close up at a single leaf, you're always going to see essentially the same branching pattern. That's a fractal. You can create the same effect with large-scale narratives in novels that run in series, such as George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. There's a single binary question posed by Martin's books. Who will sit on the Iron Throne and be the king or queen of Westeros? But because the books involve so many rival factions and so many individual characters, this larger binary plot is made up of a huge number of smaller but no less compelling binary plots at nearly every level. Just below the level of the main binary question are several largest questions. Will the Starks defeat the Lannisters? Will the Night's Watch keep the White Walkers north of the Wall? Will Daenerys Targaryen bring her dragons back to Westeros? These separate plot lines play out over the course of several books. Below that level are binary questions that play out over the course of a single book. For example, will Brienne of Tarth deliver Jaime Lannister to King's Landing? These single-volume plot lines usually involve the fate of a single character or pair of characters. Within each book, each individual chapter can also be plotted out as a little Freytag pyramid. In each chapter, the point of view character, whether it's Tyrion Lannister or Arya Stark or Daenerys Targaryen, is usually faced with a problem at the beginning of the chapter, which is resolved or complicated by the end of the chapter. Obviously, these little pyramids are not as complex or detailed as the overarching one that describes the whole narrative. For example, with many of the chapters, you already know the characters and the setting, so Martin can dispense with exposition. But even so, Martin's narrative uses a traditional narrative pyramid, situation, conflict, climax, resolution, at every level. There's one overarching pyramid that governs the whole story, but it's made up of lots of smaller pyramids. The plot of A Song of Ice and Fire is a fractal, in other words. You can see the same pattern at every level, whether it's the whole series, an individual book, or an individual chapter. It's pyramids all the way down. If you've ever wondered, as I have, how Martin keeps all these plot lines and characters and all that backstory straight, I think this structure may be the key to it. By breaking the larger story down into smaller pieces and breaking those pieces into even smaller pieces, it's possible for him to move ahead with a really huge narrative without getting lost or discouraged. Now, for those of us who aren't planning to write a narrative that runs for 10,000 pages, there are other ways you can run interesting variations on the Freytag pyramid that don't involve keeping track of hundreds of characters. For example, you can create something I'll call a leapfrogging or contrapuntal narrative. There's a lot of variations to this, but I'll limit it to four. The first is a narrative that tells a single story, but tells it from the points of view of multiple characters, each one taking a turn before handing the story off to another character. Perhaps the most famous example of this is William Faulkner's novel, As I Lay Dying. This book tells the story of the Bundrans, a family of Mississippi farmers, and how they cope with the death of the family's mother, Addie. Before she died, Addie made her husband, Anse, promise that he'd bury her in the town of Jefferson, which is an inconvenient distance away. The novel is a blackly comic account of how the family carries her coffin all the way to town. He could have told the story in a straightforward fashion with a third-person narration, but instead, Faulkner decided to narrate the entire novel from the points of view of 15 different characters. Each character speaks in the first person, trading off with the other members of the family, as well as with people they meet along the way. It's a technically adventurous book, but it tells an old-fashioned story, one that includes all the elements of the Freytag pyramid. The difference is that each piece of the story is told by a different character. Another type of leapfrogging or contrapuntal narrative you could try is the one that tells several equally important stories that remain separate for much of the book, but which come together at the end for a single climax. In fact, A Song of Ice and Fire is a crazily complex version of this type of narrative, but let's look at a slightly simpler version. There's no more old-fashioned a storyteller than J.R.R. Tolkien, and his masterpiece, The Lord of the Rings, builds to one of the biggest climaxes in the history of literature, namely the eruption of Mount Doom in the third volume of the trilogy, The Return of the King. But if you look at how he gets there, Tolkien is a surprisingly adventurous plotter. By the end of the first volume, The Fellowship of the Ring, the story essentially splits into three equally important strands. You have the story of Frodo, Sam, and Gollum making their way to Mordor. You have the story of Merry and Pippin's kidnapping by the orcs. And you have the story of Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli as they search for Merry and Pippin. Again, there's an overarching story here, namely the quest to destroy the One Ring. You also have a single overarching chronology. But while you're reading The Lord of the Rings, You're shifting back and forth among the three stories, which take place at vast distances from each other, even if they take place at the same time. If you outline the whole story, taking into account all of its various branches, you'll see a lot of smaller Freytag pyramids, the way you would with A Song of Ice and Fire. Let me recommend two more styles of contrapuntal narrative. One is commonly used by modern historical novelists. The old-fashioned historical novel focuses exclusively on a period or an episode in the past, but a number of contemporary historical novels weave two main stories together, usually a story from the past and a story from the present, which are linked somehow. A great example is A.S. Byatt's novel Possession. The historical half of the novel is about a passionate love affair between two Victorian poets, and the contemporary half is about a group of modern academics who are competing with each other to find out the truth about this long-rumored affair. It's fundamentally an old-fashioned plot, and it builds to a very spooky climax in a graveyard at night. It's made up of two equal plot lines which feature characters who can never meet with each other because they live in different centuries. And yet the outcome of one plot determines the outcome of the other. There are other parallelisms as well. The pair of lovers in the 19th century are matched by a pair of lovers among the competing academics in the 20th century, for example. And there's one more type of leapfrogging narrative. As I've said before, the basic murder mystery is usually a contrapuntal story. It's the most basic kind of binary plot there is: who killed the victim? But the answer is often arrived at in a complicated way. There's the present-day story, which usually starts with the discovery of the body and follows the progress of the investigation. And then there's the story of the recent past, which ends with the murder. Looked at chronologically, one story, that of the murder, ends just as the other story, that of the investigation, begins. But the way most murder mysteries are structured, you start with the investigation and work backwards into the story of the murder, learning it in bits and pieces, and often out of chronological order. Nobody would call most murder mysteries avant-garde, but even the most run-of-the-mill of them does interesting things with plot and chronology. In the next lecture, I'm going to talk some more about the traditional plot, taking a look at ways you can rearrange or adapt the individual pieces of it, plus some other common techniques you can use to make the plot more complex and intriguing. We'll be looking at examples from Shirley Jackson, James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and Flannery O'Connor. And in the lecture after that, I'll talk about the plotless or non-traditional narrative. These narratives work outside the lines of the Freytag pyramid, but each one nevertheless has a structure. Every work of fiction has a structure, even if it doesn't have a plot. In the meantime, I'll leave you with a very simple but very fruitful exercise. Take some of your favorite books or movies or television shows and see if you can graph them on Freytag's pyramid. I think you'll find a couple of interesting things. One is how common a structure it is, but you'll also find how often the structure of narrative is not a single pyramid, but a more complicated tangle of many pyramids, like the structures of As I Lay Dying, or Middlemarch, or A Song of Ice and Fire. If you don't want a traditionally structured plot to become a straitjacket, you need to walk a fine line between being too predictable on the one hand and disappointing the reader on the other. You want the reader to be satisfied and not feel betrayed by your climax, but on the other hand, you don't want them to see it coming. This particular structure has survived for a couple thousand years, partly because it can be reassuring. But it has also survived because it has turned out to be remarkably adaptable and capable of being bent into all sorts of interesting shapes without breaking.
Lecture 11, Adding Complexity to Plots.
In my first lecture on plot, I talked about the difference between story and plot. In the second lecture, I explained that many narratives have the same basic Aristotelian structure of situation, conflict, and resolution. This structure is also known as Freytag's pyramid, with its separate stages of exposition, inciting incident, rising action, climax, falling action, resolution, and denouement. I also said that you can play interesting variations on this basic plot structure that makes plotting both interesting and challenging. The underlying story in Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim fits Freytag's pyramid fairly well if you lay it out chronologically. But the way Conrad rearranges that chronology helps make Lord Jim one of the greatest novels ever written.